إن الحمد لله نحمده ونستعينه ونستغفره ونؤمن به توكل عليه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له أما بعد One of the topics that I am quite passionate about is reviving a way of thinking about family and community. You know, I believe in the past two decades, we've become too individualistic in our thinking. Most people these days are unable to think outside of themselves. Life's become all about me, all about my ego, all about my desires, my goals. People don't think as families anymore. People don't think as communities anymore. They don't think as part of an ummah anymore. Many people can only think about themselves. And there are many topics that need to be discussed to fix this. Right, and I'm going to spend a few weeks discussing some of these topics, but today I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to go to the biography of a very interesting scholar that you might not be aware of. And from his biography, I'm going to then go into some of his writings and teachings about family that may help you to think differently about family. You see, one of the problems we have today amongst the youth is that many of them don't want to get married. And when they weigh the benefits of being single against the benefits of being married, in their minds, for many of them, there's more benefits in being single, right? Many young people think of marriage and family as a responsibility, as a burden, as something that's getting in the way of their dreams. And we need to fix this way of thinking. So today I want to share with you something I read recently that really reshape the way I think about family. I've been reading through the writings of Shaykhul Islam Mustafa Sabri Effendi, rahimahullah. Not sure if any of you have heard about him. He was the last or second last Shaykhul Islam of the Ottoman Empire. A very important individual. And his writings are very important and relevant to our times. So just a bit about who this man is before we get into his teachings about family. Sheikh Mustafa Sabri was born in the 1800s, around 1860. And he passed away around 1950, right? He lived through the fall of the Ottoman Empire. But he didn't just live through the fall of the Ottoman Empire. He was one of the most important people in the Ottoman Empire. Mustafa Sabri was born into a scholarly family and became one of the most important leading Hanafi scholars in the Ottoman Empire to such an extent that when Sultan Abdul Hamid began his project for trying to save the Ottoman Empire, trying to preserve it from falling apart, Mustafa Sabri was one of those scholars he hired for this project. He worked very closely with the Khalifa in trying to prevent the Ottoman Empire from falling apart. And in the year 1923, Mustafa Sabri was promoted to Sheikhul Islam. Sheikhul Islam is the highest position that a scholar can get in the Ottoman Empire. The Sheikhul Islam is essentially the Grand Mufti and the Chief Qadi, the Chief Judge of the Ottoman Empire. The one person who has the most authority to interpret the Sharia. He was put into this position in 1923. Anyone remember when the Ottoman Empire collapsed? 1924, just 1 year later. He came into this position too late. By the time Mustafa Sabri became Sheikhul Islam, the Kemalists, the secularists, had already taken over Turkey. And they were trying to dismantle the Khilafat, and 1 year later they would be successful in dismantling the Khilafat. And so his time as Sheikhul Islam was a very shaky time because he was trying to preserve the Sharia and the new leaders were trying to dismantle the Sharia. And sadly he lost his battle and he was removed from his position and the Sharia was dismantled and the Khilafat was dismantled and we are still living in the aftermath of that. After the Khilafat was dismantled, Mustafa Sabri found himself in a very strange position. He was the chief sheikh of the Ottoman Empire, and now there is no Ottoman Empire. Now there's nation states and secularism and liberalism, and nobody wants him. Nobody wants a pious scholar who's talking about Islam and calling people back to Islam. He now has to leave the country, and he moves from land to land seeking a new place to live. And nobody wants him. He goes to France, he goes to Algeria, he goes to many different places. Eventually he settles in Egypt. And even in Egypt, people don't really like what he's saying. Egypt in the 1930s was very much influenced by feminism and liberalism. It had become a very westernized land, and he talks a lot about this in his writings. And the people living in Egypt at that time did not like what Mustafa Sabri had to say. But he settled there, and he dedicated the rest of his life to writing books. Very, very powerful books. Some of the most important books produced in the past 100 years. His books were focused primarily on refuting modern ideologies. This is in the 1930s. He wrote books against liberalism, secularism, feminism. All of these different ideologies, he wrote books against them in the 1930s. And one of the topics that he emphasized a lot in these books was the importance of preserving the family. It's interesting to see the different phases of his life. When Mustafa Sabri was young, his goal was to preserve the Ottoman Empire, to protect it from collapsing. That failed after World War I and the Ottoman Empire collapsed. His goal after that was to try and revive the Khilafat. Like, okay, the Ottoman Empire collapsed, maybe we can have another Khilafat. But within a few years, he realized the Ummah is too divided, these nation states are going to be here for a while, we're not going to have a Khilafat anytime soon. Then he switches gears to trying to protect the Iman of people through his writings by refuting modern ideologies. But what's interesting at this point is that a key focus of his in refuting modern ideologies is emphasizing the importance of family. Why? Why does he talk so much about family? This is something I found very interesting about his writings. At the time when the Khilafat had just collapsed, people had fallen into secularism and liberalism and all of these other isms, Mustafa As-Sabri talks a lot about family. He talks a lot about the importance of preserving family, the importance of having a big family, having a strong family, having a righteous family. You see, one of the key points that stood out from his writings to me is he talks about families as power structures. This is very interesting. Many of us, they don't think of families as power structures. We just think of families as, you know, the people we know. You know, somebody, you grow up with your siblings and then you go your own way. That's not how families were looked at historically. In Islam, power is decentralized. No one person has all the power. The Khalifa has a certain level of power, but there's limits to his power. Right? For example, the Khalifa cannot interpret the Sharia. It's the ulama who interpret the Sharia. So the Khalifa cannot interfere with what the law is. The law comes from the ulama, not from the Khalifa. So there's limits to his power. So the Khalifa is one type of power. The ulama are a different type of power. The judges are a different type of power. But the head of the household is also a different type of power. In Islam, a family or a tribe is a unit of power. It's a power structure. And the head of the household or the tribal chief has actual power in the community. To such an extent that in the Hanafi Madhab and specifically in the Ottoman Empire, the head of the household functioned as a mini Khalifa. Right? The level of power that a man has in his home under the Hanafi Madhab is almost like a mini Khalifa. What does this mean? It means, for example, in the Ottoman Empire, if you were a man and you had your wives and your children and your grandchildren, and you had like a huge compound in which your whole family lived, how you run that compound is not the government's business. What rules you have for your family is not the government's business. As long as you are not oppressing anyone, as long as you are not harming anyone, how you run your house is your own business. That a man literally operated as a mini Khalifa with his family. And this meant if a person had a big family, if somebody had a large family, they would be very powerful. They would be very influential. So what's interesting is that Sheikh Mustafa As-Sabri, he noticed a couple of trends happening in the Muslim world that he found very dangerous in the 1930s. One of them, very interestingly, he talks often in his writings about a marriage crisis. Says young people can't find anyone to get married to. Right? He talks about the marriage crisis. People in the late 20s and early 30s can't find anyone to get married to. This is in the 1930s in Egypt. Very similar to what our community faces today. Right? A very similar situation. He talks about the marriage crisis. And he talks about the things that led to the marriage crisis. The rise of zina, people delaying marriage because of education. Very similar to what we are facing today. But another problem he talks about is how Muslims turned against polygamy. This is very interesting, right? So the way Mustafa As-Sabri approaches this topic is he says that throughout the bulk of Muslim history, nobody had a problem with polygamy. It was a normal practice in the Muslim world. Colonization happens, the British force their values on the Muslims, and suddenly the Muslims now start looking at polygamy and polygamous families as a bad thing. So he argues in his writings, specifically in his Qawl al-Mar'a, his views on womanhood, he argues for the importance of polygamy. And he argues for it from a very interesting angle about families being power structures. So he said in the past, if a man had four wives and seven children from each wife, he's a very powerful member of the community. Every member of that family is going to protect each other. Every member of that family is going to care for each other. You can't oppress any member of that family because the rest of the family is going to team up and help them. But family is huge. You have more people there who are likely to protect you and help you against external forces. And he said that the reason why they tried to get rid of polygamy in the Muslim world was to make families smaller, to make families weaker. So now a man goes from having a large family to a smaller family. In our time, even smaller family. Our times, many people don't think of family as protection, they think of family as inconvenience. Right? And the important metaphor here, you say that the wolf goes after the lone sheep. It doesn't go after the sheep in the flock. And this is what's happening to the Ummah today. People are going out alone. They say, I don't need family, I don't need community, I don't need anybody, I can take care of myself. That's when you're most vulnerable to shaitan. That's when you're most vulnerable to the elements of society. When you don't have people around you to keep you in check, to protect you. Not just to protect you from external forces, but from your own self, from your own nafs. And so this is a key teaching that Mustafa As-Sabri rahimahullah emphasizes over and over again in his writings for the rest of his life, that families are meant to protect each other. They are meant to be a sense of security. That if you have a large family, you have many members of the family who are there to protect each other. If things go wrong, your family will be there for you. If things go wrong, you have people there who can take care of you. And in life, things do go wrong. He lived in a time when things went very, very wrong. Remember, this man lived through World War I and World War II. Right? He lived in a very difficult point in history. And so he emphasizes the importance of family from this perspective, the perspective of families being a source of power. And he argues that they took away the Khilafat. They took away one source of power from the Muslims. Don't let them take away your families. Don't let them destroy the family. Because historically, the Khilafat protected Muslims from outside elements. You lived in Darul Islam, you are protected from Kufr. Now without a Khilafat, and especially for us living as minorities in non-Muslim lands, what protects you from the outside elements? What protects you from being influenced by Kufr? Your family. If you have a strong, righteous family, with a strong head of the household and a strong heart of the household, where the mother and father are righteous and committed to the deen, and they teach you the religion, you are more likely to be protected from the kufr that is being bombarded at you through the media and through society. Families are powerful. So with the young people today, when they talk about families being an inconvenience, families getting in the way of their goals, I want you to now rethink this. I want you to weigh the pros and cons. Remember, anything you choose in life is costing you something else. That's how the world works. There's always a cost. Yes, if you choose family, it may cost you some of your personal dreams, some of your free time, some of your hobbies. That's part of the cost of choosing family. But what's the cost of choosing to be alone? The cost of choosing to be alone is vulnerability. You become vulnerable to shaitan, to society, to the government. You don't have that extra layer of protection that you would have if you are part of a family, if you are committed to a family, if you and your family get along and you'll take care of each other and you'll love each other and you're there for each other. Weigh the pros and cons. Do you choose absolute freedom with the chance that if things go wrong, you are on your own? Or do you choose to be part of a family where, yes, there's responsibilities, there's limits in what you can do, but you have each other's backs. You are there for each other. And when things go wrong, you know your family are there to take care of you. And I think we start thinking like this again, perhaps young people once again see the importance of family. See the importance of being part of something bigger. We are not meant to be individuals. Right? There's a hadith that applies to community. I want you to take that hadith and apply it to family as well. The Prophet ﷺ said, the person who mixes with people and bears their harm is better than the one who is alone. It is better to mix with people and bear their harm than to be alone. Why? Because when you are alone, yes, people can't harm you, people can't fight with you, people can't argue with you, but you are vulnerable. Something happens to you, there's no one to help you. When you are part of a people, whether it's a community or a family, yes, you will get on each other's nerves. Yes, you will have differences of opinion. Yes, you may clash with each other, things may get heated. But you'll have each other's backs. The family protects the family, the community protects the community. And that makes it worth dealing with the inconvenience of the small harms that come from being part of a bigger home. So let us go back to thinking about families as a source of protection from the harmful elements of the outside world. Let's go back to thinking of families as a source of power that gives us actual influence in our communities. Strong, influential families don't just have protection for each other, but they influence the greater community as well. And this has always been the case throughout history, and it is still the case today. We need to build such families in the Muslim community so that we are influential over others instead of allowing others to have influence over us. Wa akhir da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. الحمد لله وحده والصلاة والسلام على من لا نبي بعد أما بعد فإن أصدق الحديث كتاب الله وخير هدي هدي محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم وشر الأمور محدثاتها وكل محدثة بدعة وكل بدعة ضلالة وكل ضلالة في النار. Nowadays, the young people are bombarded with many wrong messages about family, especially through social media. Seems like there's a lot of individualism being pushed on social media, telling people, you don't need a man, you don't need a woman, men are evil, women are evil. You know, all these messages are being pushed on people to make people hate the opposite gender, to make people think of marriage as something inconvenient, something that gets in the way of your freedom, something that gets in the way of your pursuing your dreams. And we need to take these topics one by one and dismantle them. So let's start with one, right? One of the ideas that are being pushed on young Muslim women today, and really on women all over the world today, is the idea that men are inherently evil. Right? This is an idea that's been pushed a lot online. That men are evil, men are trash, men are dangerous, you can't trust men. It's an idea that men are just bad. And because of this, a lot of women choose not to get married, they end up having bad relationships with their own fathers, they don't want to have sons, they just see men as a dangerous and evil thing. Understand that this concept is foreign to our religion. It's not just foreign to our religion, but if a woman believes this, it is dangerous to her iman. Why? Because if she thinks all men are evil, what would be her conclusion about the prophets of Allah, who were men? Or the great ulama of the past, who were men? Or the khulafa, who were men? Will she look at them as evil too? And some of them are doing that. You will find people online claiming that Abu Huraira was a misogynist. Imam Ghazali was a misogynist. People are saying things like this today because this is the conclusion of thinking all men are evil. That you now start to look at the great men of the past and see them as evil. So what does Islam teach us? Islam teaches us very simply. They are good men and they are bad men. They are good women and they are bad women. You can't take an entire gender and lump it like this. And this is why the Quran says righteous men are for righteous women and evil men are for evil women. It makes it very clear. Both types of people exist. You cannot label an entire gender based on the actions of evil people. This is a very toxic way to live your life. Because what happens then is even when a woman does get married, she goes into a marriage with the idea that, oh, this man is evil. Right? And I need to fix it. Or I need to keep him under control. This is not the Islamic approach. Islamically, you find yourself a good man. And a good man and a good woman together, they build a good home. So don't think of every member of the opposite gender as evil. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us in Surah At-Tawbah that the believing men and women, al-mu'minuna wal-mu'minat, ba'aduhum awliya'u ba'd. Right? The believing men and women are allies of each other. They command what is good and they forbid what is evil. Meaning righteous men and women keep each other in check. They prevent each other from doing haram. They prevent each other from going astray. This is the foundation of an Islamic community. This is the foundation of an Islamic marriage. You are there to keep each other in check, to prevent each other from falling into haram, and to trust each other and to love each other. And so we must be wary of these ideas that have been put out into the community. And we must make sure that we are having conversations with our young men and women about the idea that they are being fed. They are influential men online who are preaching the idea that all women are evil, or that all women will cheat on you, that all women are bad. This is a completely haram ideology. Righteous women do not fall into this category that they are talking about. They had experience with bad women and they are labeling all women with this. And likewise, there are women online who are labeling all men as evil, and many young people are buying into these gender ideologies. So we need to make sure that our ideology comes from the Quran and Sunnah. And the Quran and Sunnah makes it very clear that every man and woman is born upon the fitrah. They are born upon natural goodness. Society can corrupt them, but if they nurture their goodness, if they follow Allah, if they obey Allah, any man or woman can become righteous. So righteous men should marry righteous women and build righteous families and ignore all of this noise online trying to paint the opposite gender as something evil. This is not from the teachings of Islam. This is not something we agree upon, and this is something that's very dangerous to you and to your iman and to your community and to your families if you buy into these type of ideologies. We ask Allah to protect us from dangerous ideologies and to grant us the correct understanding of Islam. Rabbana atina fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasana wa qina adhaban nar. Rabbana hab lana min azwajina wa dhurriyyatina qurrata a'yun waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. Allahumma akfina bihalalik al-harami wa aghnina bi fadlika amman siwak. Subhana rabbika rabbil 'izzati 'amma yasifun wa salamun 'alal mursalin wa alhamdulillahi rabbil 'alamin. Aqim as-salah.